The headlines: a senior Iranian commander renews Tehran's promise of harsh revenge for the U.S. assassination of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. Democrats edge closer to control the U.S. Senate with 98% of votes counted in key runoff elections in the state of Georgia. And China says Hong Kong's move to arrest dozens of people over an unofficial opposition vote was necessary to stop external forces trying to undermine Beijing's stability. Hello and welcome, everybody. Here in the Iranian capital, Tehran, this is World News. Our top story for this half hour: the commander of the Quds Force of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps vowed harsh revenge for the assassination of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani.
Our duty is clear. First is to take revenge from the murderers that committed this heinous crime. The revenge began at the very first moment that they assassinated top resistance commanders, and it will reach its end point. But this revenge has several steps. The enemy has been slapped twice and will be slapped two more times in the future. The first was the huge funeral procession that was held for General Soleimani and his comrades. The second was an attack on the U.S. base in Iraq that broke the grandeur of America. The third slap will be when the U.S. hegemony will be defeated. And the last one will be the U.S. withdrawal from the region.
Brigadier General Ghani was speaking at a ceremony marking the first anniversary of Soleimani's assassination. The ceremony took place in Soleimani's hometown, Kerman, in southern Iran. Ghani said U.S. forces will be crushed first, and then they will be expelled from the West Asia region. He said the perpetrators of the crime will not be safe even in their own homes. The Iranian commander said the path of General Soleimani will continue. Soleimani was killed in a U.S. drone attack in Iraq last January. Well, ceremony is underway in Syria to mark the anniversary of the U.S. killing of General Soleimani and senior Iraqi commander Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis. The ceremony is the latest in different countries in the past few days to commemorate the anti-terror commanders. Our correspondent Muhammad Ali is joining us now from the country, Damascus countryside, to tell us more about these ceremonies. Muhammad?
Yes, I am now in Damascus countryside. There is a ceremony which will start in a few minutes, marking the first anniversary of the assassination of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. This is not the first anniversary. However, at this time, there is a large number of people attending, ordinary people, Syrians, in addition to Iranian ambassador to Syria, as well as Syrian government officials like the governor of Damascus countryside. There are representatives of Palestinian factions, Syria-based Palestinian factions, also attending. There will be speeches that will highlight and focus on the achievements of General Soleimani, particularly in Syria, what he has done for the Syrian people in the fight against, of course, the Daesh terrorists across the country. It's not the first event. There were so many previous events. What Syrians want to say in such events is that they want to express their appreciation and respect for all the efforts that General Soleimani did in Syria in order to defeat Daesh and help them restore stability to so many areas across the country. I asked so many Syrians here. They said that they truly know that General Soleimani, without his efforts and without his command in so many fights and battles against the terrorists in Syria, stability wouldn't have been restored to areas like Al-Bukamal on the borderline with Syria, areas around Damascus, areas south of Aleppo. There are also several other ceremonies happening right now. One is at Sfera in Aleppo countryside. There is even another one happening that will happen next Friday. So you can see that ceremonies marking this anniversary in Syria are happening just before the anniversary itself and even after it, which shows how much appreciation Syrians have for General Soleimani.
Muhammad, if you can also explain for us how pivotal Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani was, or how pivotal he is considered in maintaining and establishing security in the region, specifically when we're talking about the aftermath of the rise of Daesh.
Yes, General Soleimani, of course, was heading all of the Iranian military advisors who were in Syria at the request of the Syrian government, assisting the Syrian army and the Syrian National Defense Forces to defeat terrorism and terrorists in general. And now, General Soleimani, personally led so many battles against terrorists, for example, Al-Bukamal in 2017. He managed to lead all of the Syrian troops over there, the Syrian National Defense Forces, the Syrian Army, the Lebanese Resistance Forces movement, Hezbollah, of course, who were fighting all alongside the Syria side to get rid of Daesh. General Soleimani also helped in restoring security and stability to areas south of Aleppo, areas around Damascus. So the security that the Syrians are living in so many parts across the country, especially in the east, like Deir ez-Zor, also in the north near Aleppo, thanks to General Soleimani, the security and stability there was restored. General Soleimani helped Syria for long years against terrorism, not just Daesh, all kinds of terrorism that wanted to, you know, undermine stability and security in Syria. Also, the importance of Al-Bukamal itself was that General Soleimani reopened that gateway between Iraq and Syria, which Daesh, assisted by the U.S. over there in that part of Syria, wanted to close, thus opening a gateway between Iran, Iraq, Syria, and Lebanon. That's how important General Soleimani's role was, not just for Syria, but for the region in general. General Soleimani was aiming to assist the Syrians, the Palestinians, the Palestinian resistance, the Lebanese resistance, all, of course, in order to face that Western plot against the country, the region in general.
All right, thanks a lot, Muhammad Ali, joining us from Damascus countryside. Elsewhere, Iran's defense minister says there is solid evidence of Israel's role in the November assassination of Iranian nuclear scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. Amir Hatami said Israeli intelligence services have a history of direct involvement in similar assassinations in Iran. He made the comments in separate messages to counterparts in 60 countries. Iranian defense minister called Fakhrizadeh's assassination an inhumane act. He said Iran has the right to hold the perpetrators accountable. Hatami argued that inaction would lead to the repeat of such incidents and insecurity. He also said the global fight against terrorism requires nations to refrain from double standards. Mohsen Fakhrizadeh was killed in a terrorist attack near Tehran. Iran's President Hassan Rouhani has hailed the nation's resistance against U.S. sanctions and its economic war. Rouhani said Iran has emerged victorious despite hardships caused by the U.S. sanctions. He said Iran's economy grew in spring and summer despite restrictions caused by the coronavirus pandemic. Rouhani said the country is working on new development projects and inaugurates them on a weekly basis. The Iranian president called on the new U.S. administration to commit to its international obligations and abide by law. He said if the U.S. does so, Iran will fully meet its commitments, too. The United States has imposed sanctions against Iran's steel industry and seized millions of dollars of Iranian assets abroad. The sanctions have targeted a dozen Iranian steel and metal manufacturers and a Chinese company that makes elements for steel production. Among the blacklisted firms is Iran-based Middle East Mines and Mineral Industries Development Holding Company. The U.S. Treasury Department says it is also designating the company's subsidiaries and sales agents in Germany, China, and the U.K. The U.S. Justice Department has also busted $7 million in Iranian assets. The department says the money will be used to compensate victims of state terrorism. The restrictions are part of the outgoing U.S. president's administration's maximum pressure campaign against Iran. Tehran has repeatedly condemned the sanctions, saying they amount to economic terrorism. Political commentator Jason Unruh says the new anti-Iran sanctions are part of a broader strategy by Washington to force Tehran to bow to its will on renegotiating the nuclear deal.
Well, the fact is the United States, particularly under U.S. President Donald Trump, has pursued a policy of perhaps trying to create a new JCPOA agreement. They completely just destroyed the existing one and started placing new pressure on Iran to try to get them to come to the negotiating table when there was already an agreement there. And I assume it's in order to change the terms. I suspect that perhaps the original agreement did not do the damage that they had hoped that it would. They had hoped to hold back Iran economically from the agreement, but it has not done the damage that they wanted. Strategy to punish the Islamic Republic for not bowing to U.S. will. And this seizure of assets is just going along more with the economic war that has been placed on the country, sanctions which have no actual international standing that have been forced on the country.
The Iranian army is conducting a large-scale drill involving hundreds of domestically made drones on the second and final day of the maneuvers. Air interception operations were carried out using the Army's Qatar drones. The combat aircraft tracked down mock enemy targets and destroyed them. As they were flying at a high altitude, the pilotless planes also bombed mock enemy positions on the ground. The exercises are taking place in Iran's northeastern province of Samnan. The Army's ground, air defense, and naval force are taking part in the drill. Participating units practicing flying unmanned aerial vehicles for combat, reconnaissance, and kamikaze missions, as well as electronic warfare. Democrats are on the path to victory in Senate runoff elections in the U.S. state of Georgia with approximately all the votes counted. U.S. media have projected Democrat Raphael Warnock as the winner of one of the two runoffs against Republican Senator Amy Loeffler. The other contest between John Ossoff and incumbent Republican David Perdue continues with a narrow lead for the Democratic candidate. The outcome of the Georgia elections will determine which party would gain control of the Senate. Republicans need the victory of either of their candidates to preserve their majority in the Senate. Democrats, however, must gain control over both seats to capture a majority in both houses of the U.S. Congress. Washington, D.C. correspondent Colin Campbell joined us early with a breakdown of why the Senate races are decisive for U.S. politics.
Right now, if the Republicans win, that would mean that they have a majority in the Senate. If President-elect Joe Biden, or when President-elect Joe Biden becomes president and he wants legislation passed, Republicans can block that legislation. So anything progressive or Democratic that the Democrats want to put forward to change the country or just to change the growing wealth disparity, the COVID-19 vaccine rollout, some of the police brutality issues and justice and racism issues, those may not come to the fore if you have Republicans in the Senate that can block a lot of that activity. Now, the flip side is if the Democrats win, well, then you have a possibility of a 50, you have the 50-50 split, right? Each state gets two senators. And the person who would break that tie would be the vice president, who would be a Democrat. Vice President-elect Kamala Harris would be the vice president. She would break any ties on legislation that just goes straight down partisan lines.
Protesters have rallied in Washington, D.C. ahead of the affirmation of U.S. President-elect Joe Biden's victory in the November presidential election. Demonstrators supporting President Donald Trump came out to show frustration at the outcome of the race for the White House. Police at some point fired tear gas to disperse the protesters. Similar rallies are planned by multiple pro-Trump groups for Wednesday. That's when Joe Biden's win is slated to be certified by Congress. President Trump has said he will address the rally of supporters on Wednesday. Authorities in the U.S. Capitol have already boosted security. The city has mobilized the National Guard and issued a warning to protesters against carrying any sort of firearms. U.S. prosecutors in the state of Wisconsin have cleared a white police officer of criminal charges in the shooting of African-American Jacob Blake. The court ruled that Officer Rustin Chesky acted in self-defense in the shooting. It said Blake was armed with a knife and had resisted arrest. The incident occurred on August the 23rd after police responded to a domestic dispute call. Chesky shot Blake seven times at close range in the presence of his children. He was paralyzed from the waist down. The incident caused widespread anti-racism protests across the U.S. The shooting took place as anger was boiling over police brutality after another black man, George Floyd, was choked to death in May. China has condemned a new U.S. ban on a series of Chinese applications accusing Washington of bullying.
I think this is another example of the U.S.'s bullying, hegemonic behavior in stretching the concept of national security, abusing national power, and unreasonably suppressing foreign companies.
The Chinese official said the U.S. ban would harm the interests of Washington and American consumers. She said China would take necessary measures to safeguard the legitimate rights of its targeted companies. On Tuesday, President Donald Trump signed an executive order banning transactions with eight Chinese software applications. The move is the latest in curbs by the Trump administration on Chinese companies. Washington accuses them of posing a threat to its national security. China has defended Hong Kong's move to arrest dozens of people over an unofficial opposition vote.
The normal rights and freedoms enjoyed by the Hong Kong people have not been affected. What may be affected is only the kind of freedom of some external forces and individuals in Hong Kong to collude with each other to attempt to undermine China's stability and security.
The Chinese official was speaking hours after Hong Kong police said they had arrested 53 people. The city security secretary said the arrest was part of an operation targeting people suspected of overthrowing the government. Those arrested were tied to an unofficial vote in July 2020 to select opposition candidates for a postponed legislative election. The arrests were made under a national security law China passed in June. Hong Kong opposition says the law would curtail freedoms there. Beijing says it would boost security in the city. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un says his five-year economic plan has failed to meet its goals in almost every sector. Kim made the remark as he opened a Congress of the ruling Workers' Party. The North Korean leader said the Congress would analyze the experiences and mistakes made during the period under review. North Korea has been under economic pressure in the past years due to U.S.-pushed sanctions over its nuclear program. Part of the sanctions were due to be lifted following talks between Washington and Pyongyang in 2018 and 19. The removal was in return for North Korea's denuclearization, but the U.S. has refused to do so. Talks have remained deadlocked for months now. Saudi Arabia has finally decided to lift a border blockade on Qatar. The move is seen as a major step toward ending a diplomatic rift that saw Riyadh leading an alliance to isolate Doha for over 3 years. We have a report.
Saudi Arabia seems changing its diplomatic course with regard to neighboring Qatar as the years-long blockade by Riyadh and some of its allies failed to force Doha to bow to their demands. The Kuwaiti foreign minister announced a diplomatic breakthrough, saying Saudi Arabia has decided to reopen its air, land, and sea borders to Qatar. Following the announcement, Qatar's Emir Sheikh Tamim bin Hamad Al Thani accepted an invitation to attend a regional Arab summit in Saudi Arabia. Upon his arrival to the Saudi city of Al Ula, Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman gave a warm welcome to Sheikh Tamim. In the summit, the leaders of the six-member Persian Gulf Cooperation Council signed a rapprochement agreement, although the details were not immediately released. During the meeting, however, bin Salman missed no chance to repeat his anti-Iran rhetoric, describing Tehran's missile program as a threat to the region. But what actually had caused the conflict between Doha and Riyadh? In June 2017, Saudi Arabia, together with Bahrain, the United Arab Emirates, and Egypt, accused Qatar, among other things, of meddling in regional affairs and supporting terrorism. They cut ties and transport links with Qatar. Ironically, Saudi Arabia is accused of the same charges it is leveled against Qatar. Doha also repeatedly denied the allegations and said it was targeted because it followed an independent foreign policy. The boycotting countries then issued a list of 13 demands to Doha, including a downgrade in relations with Iran and the closure of the Al Jazeera television news network in return for the reconciliation. Qatar has not publicly bowed to any of the demands. Saudi Arabia has constantly pursued the policy of fueling regional tensions. Some of its allegations against Qatar even demonstrated Saudi hypocrisy, as the kingdom has long been engaged in regional conflicts. While its interference in Libya and Bahrain, as well as its anti-Iran rhetoric, is not hidden anymore, the kingdom's full-fledged war on impoverished Yemen has also exposed its hegemonic agenda. Undoubtedly, Riyadh's decision to ease the Qatar blockade proves the failure of its policy of siege and aggression. However, the credit goes to Doha, that stood firm against what it called bullying by some Arab states, and so were the Qatari citizens, who seemed galvanized by patriotic feelings.
And that brings us to an end here on this edition of the World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. The Gate of Knowledge. Exegesis and interpretations of the supremely eloquent sermons, letters, and sayings of the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him.
You're listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين. Dear listeners to IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I welcome you all to this episode of The Gate of Knowledge, where we are discussing about the sermons and letters and sayings of Imam Ali alayhi salam in Nahjul Balagha. And we reach this phrase, of course, where Imam Ali alayhi salam talks about the issue of contentment, where he says, "Tarahu qani'atan nafsu." You will see that he is content, his state of his nafs, of his soul, is filled with contentment. And of course, we talked about the issue of the legislative and the existential will of God, whereby when Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala gives some rules, that, you know, based on these rules you are not supposed to perform a certain act or enjoy beyond this level of enjoyment. This is where a person needs to be content. Of course, sometimes it is the existential or the ontological will of God, whereby God wills a certain form of restriction ontologically. So, for example, a person is born without an eye, one eye, let us say, and he wants another eye, he feels like seeing, but his existential level does not allow that to happen because that was the will of God, basically, that he was born that way. Or, for example, his economic situation is a bit stringent. However much he works hard, his state economically does not change. That is, for example, another example of the existential will of God. And there are other examples, and inshallah we shall deal with very soon.
You are listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio, a program that presents a detailed commentary of Peak of Eloquence from the Master of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace be upon him.
Now, when it comes to the ontological will of God, there are times where God wills a certain form of constriction whereby a person is limited existentially to perform certain actions or to enjoy certain pleasures. In this sense, for example, well, it is permissible to live in a good house. It's not legislatively restricted. But ontologically, this person doesn't have the capacity to have that house, that type of a house, isn't it? So, in such a situation where a person has done his efforts, has worked hard, has struggled, but this restriction, ontological restriction, has caused him not to be able to achieve what he wants. In such a situation, again, the issue of contentment becomes important. It plays a very big role, a very big role. So when a person has this, monotheistic worldview, whereby he sees everything to be God's and from God and everything returning towards God, and he sees true perfection in being close to God, this is when that contentment, of course, will reach that person. And that is why in some of the du'as, some of the supplications of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam, where they say that, O Allah, the one who has you has everything, even if he doesn't have anything else. And the one who has everything apart from you has nothing. So this is the type of contentment that a believer needs to slowly and gradually achieve, whereby everything he gets just because he is with God. Being with God is enough for that person. When that person is in remembrance of God, because he knows that he is with God, he's happy and he's content. So that ontological restriction that he has, he needs to turn it to an opportunity to achieve that state of contentment. We need to use these material and constrictions and restrictions that happen in our lives to bring about that change that is needed in our souls and our hearts.
Stay tuned to the IRIB English Radio.
Now, when we talk about this issue of this, ontological or existential constriction or restriction that a person might have in his life, this is a very important place where a person needs to build that issue of contentment, that good quality of contentment in the heart. Another example that we have from the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam is that Imam says that if nothing in the world was there apart from the Quran, I wouldn't be feeling alienated or scared or alone. I wouldn't feel bad. You see, the Quran is enough for me. This is a slowly that state that we need to achieve. And this is a state where you are pleased with the will of God. In a way, being pleased with the will of God is together kind of with the state of contentment. But now, of course, we will come to later on to explain that this state of contentment quality of contentment doesn't mean that a person does not perform actions with effort, or he should lose all his effortfulness, and his desire to progress. These things have to be explained very well. We need to understand them very well. It doesn't mean that. Being content doesn't mean being lazy. Being content means being pleased when the possibility of being to do something greater is not there, either because of a legislative restriction or because of an ontological restriction. But if these restrictions, the ontological and the legislative restrictions, are not there, anything that would be anything positive that would lead to perfection is something that we need to work hard towards. So this is a very important criterion that I've mentioned today, inshallah. And let us pray to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that we work hard, of course, but at the same time, be content. Be content with the will of God, with what God has decided in all senses, but progress in what God has permitted us and what will cause us to reach higher in the general perfection that we have and other human beings have. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome, on the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio.
Inside Israel. The year 2020 is coming to an end. For Israel, it was a year of crises, from the political deadlock, which many argue is still ongoing, to the continuous anti-regime protests. Tel Aviv has had a lot on its plate. What are the protesters protesting? Well, every crisis Israel is in. First and foremost, they want an end to the coalition regime led by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. They also want the regime to finally pass a 2020 budget. Yes, that's right. Israel has yet to pass a 2020 budget, impacting many Israelis.
This thing against the Prime Minister, who's involved in the 3 accusation. He should resign immediately, in my opinion, because the way the country goes, it's the wrong direction.
The latest NGO group says this is impacting many Israelis. The group says that over 20% of Israelis are living in poverty, and hundreds of thousands of children don't have meals to eat at home. That was in 2019. According to Israel's latest, that number shot up about 50% this year.
So now we are facing winter. And I personally know people who sometimes sit at home with 3 blankets because they're afraid to turn on the heating because they're concerned that they won't have enough money to pay electricity, for example. So when you see in the society elderly people or children who live in severe food insecurity and poverty, you understand that this is not the right way, and we must morally and ethically and humanly, in terms of human and humanitarian approach, to take care of these vulnerable populations. The minimum wage is not high enough, so people who earn minimum wage also live in poverty. So this is one arena. We also need to invest in education, in housing, in the health system, that more people invest private money if they have to get better health treatment. But if you don't have money, so sometimes you won't get the right treatment, or if you don't have money at all, you won't buy medicine, for example, because you need to pay the house rent and so on. So the some examples is, for example, to increase the minimum wage, and also the allocations that the government give to families with the children or to elderly people. I'll give you an example. If you're an elderly people in Israel and you don't have pension, and you relate only on the government allocation, you will live in a poor situation. I mean, you will be poor. So this is something that we must change, because elderly people cannot go to work. And if they rely only on the governmental aid, it must make them live in dignity.
Israel had to have a third election in April just to form a coalition cabinet. Even then, Israel was going for a fourth election. The political deadlock in Israel is taking its toll on the economy, policies, and society, as the current caretaker cabinet is limited in its ability to enact concrete policies. The situation has become so bad that there is a butter crisis, where shoppers cannot find butter due to an acute butter shortage that has been blamed on Israel's political deadlock. The regime has yet to pass a budget for 2020. According to the latest NGO, there are 2.3 million Israelis living in poverty, but that figure is up 50%, latest claims. The other is by National Insurance Institute, which reported that the elderly and children are most vulnerable. Things are going for the worst too. Earlier this year, Israel's economy has entered the biggest recession since Israel was incepted onto Palestinian lands in 1948. According to the OECD, Israel's debt-to-GDP ratio is expected to be 75% this year and rise to 88% in 2022. Moreover, 20% of the Israeli working population is unemployed. With two lockdowns because of the coronavirus and a third one looming, Israeli workers and business owners are angry. Small business owners even went on a strike and led a rebellion against regime orders to lock down. To make matters even worse, the political deadlock seems to be ongoing, as yet a fourth election in less than 2 years also looms in Israel.
The problem is that many budgets, such particularly for old people, for children who need help in terms of development or things of the sort, so these budgets that normally would be extended or added, these budgets are basically frozen. So as a result, you can see quite a few programs that are frozen and population that do not receive the social conditions that they were expecting to get. Many people vote for parties that they are not really excited about, only because they want to maintain the government or replace the government, even though they do it out of desperation, because they see that there's no significant leadership in the future. Netanyahu, who was very effective in the beginning, over the time he became exhausted. And the Netanyahu that we have today is exhausted, is not effective. All he does is cling to his political situation and fight the legal system that is working against him. So many people are really frustrated because the current government is not effective and the alternative is not serious. So we really feel that we are living in a vacuum.
On social media, the conversation was tense. Yuri says, Netanyahu deprives Israel of its annual budget, forcing hundreds of thousands of citizens into economic chaos, unemployment, and poverty. We will not give up. According to Ali, in Israel, poverty rate for Jews is about 15%, while for Arab citizens is over 50%, just like Canada's settler-native divide. Liberty and Justice for All says that's why they receive more financial aid than any place on planet Earth.
Yes, it is. Israel is still in a political deadlock, but this time there is a game changer in the way that the main competition will be between two right-wingers. And the only question is who of both of them, Benjamin Netanyahu or Gideon Saar, will be the next prime minister. Both are very tough nationalists and right-wingers, and it's not good news for Israel. But right now they are the two only candidates with chances, obviously. Not a possible government. I mean, it was a big government with very little agreements, and above all, personal things were the main issue, mainly the charges against the prime minister. And you cannot run a country, especially not in times of corona, you cannot run a country with such a government. I mean, it was very clear that this government cannot function. Above all, Prime Minister Netanyahu, I mean, he takes the responsibility. In the last years, it's not really government, because Netanyahu does whatever he wants. He really became a one-show man, for the good and for the bad, and all the responsibility is on his shoulder. For the good and for the bad, the good things that happened to Israel, the bad things that happened to Israel, they are right now all Netanyahu, because he doesn't let anyone else really to run any kind of independent policy.
One of the pivotal moments in Israel was the so-called deal of the century. Of course, it failed, but it had huge repercussions for the native Arab population of Israel. The so-called deal of the century will only impact the indigenous Arab population in Israel. The so-called deal would have made hundreds of thousands of them lose their citizenships and would change the status of their communities. It would make their neighborhoods a Palestinian enclave, cut off from the neighboring occupied West Bank by an Israeli barrier known as the Apartheid Wall. The so-called deal would put over 300,000 of them at risk of being transferred out of their ancestral home of pre-1948 occupied Palestine. So far, this won't happen, but it's not a new plot. Israel has been working on this since 1948. The population has been vocal this year over that and Israel's discriminatory and apartheid tactics against them. They believe that Israel wants them out. At least according to the debt deal of the century, Israel wanted to isolate them, to make them apart from the occupied territories. The population represents over 20% of Israel, and Tel Aviv feels threatened by them.
It could be in a practice, yes. For our generation, it's another Nakba. It's a sort of Nakba for our community. First of all, we have extended the lands all over the country, and not just in our residential areas. So as part of the Palestinian people, we have extended historical rights that we are demanding. Many of us here in the Triangle are uprooted Palestinians, which means that they are internally displaced citizens. Our original villages were destroyed back in 48 during the Nakba. We are still demanding, and we continue to demand returning to our destroyed villages like Lajon and El-Zinat and El-Kafrin. And this demand basically will be impossible if they implement this transfer. So maybe the idea is not to uproot us from our homes, but it's definitely to uproot us from our historical lands and to deny our right in these lands. So for us, this is an important issue. I believe that Netanyahu included this provision about the transfer of the Arab community of the Triangle in advance of the election as part of his campaign against Arab citizens and against the joint list, the political representative of Arab citizens in Israel. Netanyahu knows that we are influential and that our votes affect the national map in Israel and could affect who will be the prime minister in Israel. This is the reason why he is trying to weaken our struggle, to weaken our political maneuver and political activity. And part of that is basically to have less Arabs and basically to have less voters and less representatives in the Knesset. This is a clearly racist motivation. Netanyahu is very worried about our gradually influential role within Israeli politics.
A recent video on social media shows Israeli Arabs walking around in Tel Aviv pretending to be Emirates, while Israelis waited in line to be photographed with them. In fact, they were trying to show how welcoming Israelis were towards Emirates, while discriminating against the original people of the land. On social media, the conversation was tense. Abir says, it's almost like Israelis aren't racist against Arabs. Mujib says, this is the Palestinian town inside the Green Line, where the Israeli military massacred scores of defenseless Muslim civilians during the Suez War of 1956.
The deal of the century is there to serve Benjamin Netanyahu and Donald Trump. It is about the Jews, it's about the Israelis. It turns a blind eye to the Palestinians, to the plight, to their cause, and it is hardly a surprise that it didn't find many enthusiasts among the Palestinians. However, it was very useful in conveying the most important message to the Palestinians, that the Americans are not a negotiator, they are a side in this conflict.
No, it's dead together with Donald Trump, who is leaving the White House within 2 weeks. Nobody really took it seriously. There are those agreements with four Arab states, which I don't want to underestimate. They have some value, but this is not the deal of the century, because the deal of the century was about to solve also the Palestinian issue, which is the main issue, and the Palestinian problem was not even touched. And therefore, we better forget about the deal of the century, and we will see what will the next administration offer, but I have no expectation.
Israel is in a political deadlock. However, politically and ideologically and unethically, they are more united than ever. What they really don't agree is to be ruled by Netanyahu, but in terms of their right-wing commitment, they are actually extremely united, and the left has evaporated into total nothingness. Israel failed to make changes because the Israeli political system in the last few years is not there to serve the Israelis, but one, to serve oligarchs around the world, two, to save Netanyahu from the legal complications inflicted on himself. Is doing the best he can to save himself, but he has found out that at least within the political system, he has a growing number of opponents. However, the Israeli public still support him and will support a government under his leadership. They like him.
According to the report by the latest nonprofit, the portion of Israeli households living in poverty rose from 20.1% to 29.3% in 2020. This while the regime in Israel continues to ignore the issue, according to Israeli media. Israelis in general believe that Netanyahu is after saving himself from jail time, as he is accused of corruption and has a pending trial. Meanwhile, protests that have been taking place every week and sometimes every day for almost a year now are growing. Some believe that Israel is on the brink of an uprising that may reshape Israel forever. For now, 2020 is ending, but the crises faced by Israelis and Israel in general continue. Here is the news making the press in Israel. The Jerusalem Post. A new survey conducted by the Abraham Initiatives has found that most Arab Israelis, 58%, would participate in the Israel protest movement against Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu if it highlighted ongoing issues facing the community, such as the economic situation and housing. Likewise, almost three-fourths, 73%, support the goals of the protest movement. I-24 News. UAE said to have suspended tourist visas for Israeli travelers. Several hundred Israeli passengers who landed in Dubai recently were denied entry into the United Arab Emirates, Israeli media report. According to the reports, the incident, which saw only Israelis holding other passports as well to enter, was caused by a change in the Emirati visa policy. Times of Israel. Israeli War Minister Benny Gantz warned Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu on that he would not be Prime Minister again if Israel goes to a fourth election in 2 years, and once again urged him to pass the 2020 budget. Ynet News. At least 25 people were arrested in occupied Jerusalem Al-Quds as police clashed with thousands of ultra-Orthodox Jews protesting the construction of a light railway line passing through their neighborhoods. A light railway line is set to go through the Bar Ilan area, with opponents saying it could disrupt the bus services and bring indecent behavior into the religious community.
From me and the production team here at Inside Israel, it's goodbye for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.